Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Author and primatologist Franz Duval is with us. He has observed bonobos and how they interact with one another for more than 15 years. You know his name, you know about his work, right? And in his new book, The Bonobo and the Atheist, In Search of Humanism Among the Primates, he shows how bonobos can teach us more than just how our bodies evolved, but also, he says, our minds. If bonobos are born with an innate sense of ethics and empathy toward one another, is the same true of humans? And is there an implication in that for the meaning or meaninglessness of religion? Joining us now is Franz Duval. Welcome to WNYC. It's an honor.
I'm happy to be here.
We're taught in grade school that chimps are our closest primate relatives, but you have studied bonobos as our closest animal kin. So give us a primer. Who is closer? Does it matter? And settle this once and for all. Is it bonobo or bonobo?
I call them bonobos. I think there's no official pronunciation. The bonobo is exactly equally close to us as the chimpanzee. So in terms of genetics, we are 98.5% identical genetically to chimpanzees and bonobos, which means we are as close to a chimpanzee or bonobo as a horse is to a zebra. So that's really close. And that's why we can make these comparisons.
Except when we hear that 95% or 98.5%, and then we think of the differences in human, societal organization, in humans weighing moral choices and all these things, we think, boy, that 1.5% accounts for a lot.
Yeah, we tend to exaggerate, though. So yes, it does count for a lot, and there are a lot of differences, and our brain is actually quite a bit bigger than a chimpanzee brain or a bonobo brain. But I think we tend to exaggerate them. And so, for example, anthropologists will say, we walk on two legs. That's a very important characteristic of humans. But, you know, chickens walk on two legs. It's not that special.
There you go. Yeah. So what does fairness and compassion look like when a bonobo is doing it?
Yeah, so we look at acts of empathy. And actually, I started doing that after studies on children where they ask a family member to cry and then see how children respond to them. And they say the children touch them and stroke them. And we call that an act of sympathy or empathy. I said, well, if that's empathy, then I have plenty of it in my bonobos and chimpanzees. Because if a chimp has lost a fight and is screaming, others will approach and embrace him. If a bonobo has lost a fight, others will have sex with that individual. And all of these acts are to console them or to calm them down.
And you wrote about, for example, Peony, an elder female with arthritis in a group that you were observing, and the younger females would help her walk when she was having trouble and bring her food and water. Should we be surprised by that?
Well, I've seen so many of that kind of instances. Of course, a lot of that is anecdotal. And so, for example, Penny, our female, young females would rush to the water spigot and suck up water and bring it to her and spit it in her mouth to help her. But then later we started doing experiments. We do experiments on these chimpanzees where we set up a situation where you can get food for yourself or you can food for yourself plus me. And chimpanzees are willing to do that. Chimpanzees actually prefer the option where they get rewards for both individuals.
But what does that actually reflect in the chimpanzee? Is it survival of the species and some kind of, you know, primary impulse in that respect, keeping as many group members healthy for purely, let's say, reproductive and survival of the fittest purposes? Or is it some kind of selflessness in the way we would ascribe it to a human being?
I would say it's both, and the same is true for our species. Our capacity for empathy has had benefits in the past. We are a cooperative species that lives in societies, so we need to take care of each other. Otherwise, what's the point of living in that kind of society? So empathy is a beneficial characteristic in the long run in evolution. But at the same time, you can be genuinely altruistic as a result of it, and so you genuinely care for others. And so both things are actually true.
So listeners, any one of you have an experience with learning about morality through animals? 212-433-WNYC. What ways have your own pets maybe shed light on human/animal behavior? Any zoologists listening, veterinarians, horse whisperers, dog walkers? 212-433-WNYC. And we're talking about something more than your dog waiting by the door for you to come home, you know, or your cat nudging you while you're trying to check your email. How have your animal companions shed light on your own behavioral tics or on any sense of morality that you may have? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for the primatologist Franz De Waal, whose new book is The Bonobo and the Atheist in Search of Humanism Among the Primates. And, of course, you can post your questions or comments to our webpage at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. So some primatologists, including, I think, Jane Goodall, get accused of anthropomorphism, observing primate behavior and imposing human attributes that we may be making up because we care, it looks that way to us. You say you're reluctant to call a chimpanzee a moral being, and I'm curious why. Is it problematic to read too much into animal behavior for clues about how our own brains work?
Well, first, on anthropomorphism, I don't think it's as bad as people say it is, because if you have two species that are very closely related and have almost identical brains, like chimpanzees and humans, there's really no parts in our brains that are not present in a chimpanzee brain, and they act the same under similar circumstances, you have to assume that the psychology behind that behavior is going to be very similar too. So I don't have a lot of trouble with anthropomorphism. Now you ask, why don't I call a chimpanzee a moral being? That is because our morality goes a little bit further in the sense we are looking for justifications of our moral principles. We are looking for objectification, so rules that apply to you and me, we think ought to apply to everybody else in the world. So moral rules apply universally. And that is, of course, something that I don't see a lot of in our chimpanzees.
So the title of your book is The Bonobo and the Atheist. Why not The Bonobo and the Theologian?
The theologian will also – actually, theologians will probably have more trouble with my message than the average atheist. That's what I would say, because I'm arguing that morality is older than the current religions. The current religions are just 2,000-3,000 years old. That's really nothing for the biologist. And I think the reason I chose the word atheist is that I want to get the message across that there is hope for the atheists, in the sense that human morality is an old characteristic that we can develop even without religion. But secondly, I'm also sort of pushing the neo-atheists aside by saying that their message has gotten too loud and too strong and too polarizing, so that there's really no debate possible about these issues, because they depict believers as idiots, which is really not a good discussion opener, I think.
Does this make you a pure agnostic? Like there's no way to know, and therefore you're not even waging into this debate because it's unknowable?
I don't – you know, the agnostic doesn't know if God exists. The atheist knows that God does not exist. And I call myself an apatist. I don't particularly care if God exists. I don't think it's an interesting question. It's certainly not a question that I as a scientist will ever resolve. And I want to focus on issues like – Why are we moral beings? What is it good for? Why should we care? And so on.
You said an apathist.
Apathist.
Reflecting your apathy.
Yeah.
Toward the question. Because ultimately, whether or not God exists does not make any particular behavior right or wrong.
No. I think you can be perfectly moral without being a believer. And that's actually the message of my book, is that I think morality is older than our current religions.
Daphne in Yonkers. You're a zookeeper, Daphne? Hi there. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm calling because I had an experience where a group of our monkeys, one of them, the oldest female, was sick, and they had to go on exhibit without her while we worked her up, and ultimately she had to be put to sleep. And when they came back in, they searched through all of holding looking for her. I mean, what seemed like to me looking for her. And didn't find her, and then went back to the exhibit to look for her. And then when they didn't find her there, one of her daughters started crying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So that's not so unusual. I think animals have strong attachments, which is also true for many pets. And so when an individual goes missing, they are really upset about that. And of course, in some cases, animals will die even of loneliness if one of their best companions disappears. And so, these kind of attachments are found in many species, and it shows just how cooperative these animals are.
Along the same lines, I think, Dan in Brooklyn. Hi, Dan. You're on WNYC.
Hi. How are you doing? Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, so my question was if your guest had done any of his experiments on how the bonobos or the chimps deal with death, with the death of one of their family or fellow bonobos, and if there's bereavement, if there's a burial, if there's any, because I believe if you want to talk about comparison to human morality, that's probably the most interesting, because there's no benefit from that dead bonobo to the clan anymore. So what do they do?
Yeah. So we certainly don't do experiments on this, because that would mean that you produce the death, which is really not what we want to do. But there's many observations of how chimpanzees or bonobos react to the death of others and how they start to grieve. We've seen, for example, with chimpanzees that if one of them dies, they stop eating for a couple of days. Now, it's very hard to stop eating, and it means that they're very strongly affected by it. And I think how they react to death is important to the question of where religion comes from, because many people believe that our sense of mortality is one of the origins of human religion and the afterlife and everything like that. Now, for other animals, we do know that they have strong reactions to the death of others, but whether they know anything about their own death, which is really an extrapolation where you say, well, he died, this could happen to me. And we really don't know. There's no certainty how they experience that and whether they have a sense of mortality.
And one of the functions of religion, whether you believe in a paranormal god or not, is to provide rituals and mm-hmm. mechanisms mm-hmm. for dealing with death.
Yeah.
What replaces that in bonobo culture or any animal culture?
Yeah, bonobos and chimpanzees, they react strongly to death. And apart from stopping eating and being very silent, they sometimes try to reactivate the body. They will stare at it for a long time after death. So they're very affected by it, and they try to touch it and groom it. And so there are certain rituals involved, which I think, and for example, females, they will carry a dead offspring for weeks sometimes because they cannot let go, which is also true for many other mammals. So all these mammals have strong attachments and need to deal with death in a particular way.
Karen in New Jersey, you're on WNYC with Franz DeWall. Hello.
Oh, yeah. Hi. How are you? When my standard poodle was about 4 years old, I got a golden doodle male puppy, and she immediately adopted him as her baby. And whenever she ate, she left him a certain proportion of her food. He grew up, he became her mate, and they had puppies. And she had five puppies, and I kept one of them, and the two of them now leave a certain proportion of their food for the puppies.
Yeah. Well, we do actually, on bonobos and chimps, we do studies on that, is where we create situations where they can either eat all the food by themselves that is there, or they can leave, or they can sometimes invite in others so that they share the food with somebody else that they don't need to share it with. And all of these tendencies exist. And so some level of generosity. And some people have sometimes asked me if maybe the chimpanzees are generous because they're afraid that the other will beat them up if they're not generous. But actually, the most generous individuals in our studies are the most dominant individuals, who have least to fear. So it's, so it's not out of fear that they do these things. It's more out of real generosity.
Karen, thank you. And can you ascribe similar behavior to an animal like a poodle that's so much further down the evolutionary chain, if that's the right way to put it, than a primate?
The thing is that empathy, we do a lot of studies of emotional responses to the emotions of others. Empathy is probably a general mammalian characteristic. So it's not, and a poodle certainly is a mammal. And so there's now rodent studies. There's studies on mice and rats. There was recently a study on rats where rats could liberate a companion from a container, and they did that. And they even preferred liberating another rat than opening a container with chocolate pieces. So they had a very strong incentive to be empathic. And I think we generally look at empathy now as originating from maternal care. in the mammals, and that's why empathy is more developed in females than in males, and why oxytocin, which is a maternal hormone, if you spray it in the nostrils of human adults, men and women, you get more empathy out of them. And so empathy is probably a general mammalian characteristic, and so elephants, dolphins, dogs, all sorts of animals have it.
Could be a new way to get high. Spray yourself with some empathy drug.
Well,
they
recommend it to salespersons to
really?
Use because
wow.
they're yeah. So that's a manipulation right there.
Primatologist Franz De Waal with us. His new book, The Bonobo and the Atheist in Search of Humanism Among the Primates. And you're right that early humans living in small groups didn't really need a supernatural supervisor, as you put it. It's only when our ancestors began to form larger groups, larger societies. With bigger groups came the need for bigger gods. You're right. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so the big puzzle is, of course, why do humans have religions? Why do all people in the world believe in the supernatural? And why do all people have some sort of religion? Which for the biologist must mean that religion provides some benefits. Otherwise, we wouldn't do that kind of thing. And so we think that moralizing gods started with large-scale societies. So in a small-scale society, you're basically in the same situation as bonobos and chimpanzees in the sense that everyone keeps an eye on everybody. We know how you behave, and we will punish you if you don't behave well. We will support you if you behave well. And so we have all sorts of mechanisms in place. But when you go to 1,000 people or several thousand or millions, that mechanism doesn't really work anymore. And so you need something else. And that's why we think humans invented gods who keep an eye on everybody, because in large-scale societies we needed some additional mechanism.
Susan in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Susan.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
It is such a pleasure to listen to this program.
Thank you.
So it is just wonderful. I wrote the book Gentle Gorilla, which was the story of Patty Cake. I was with her from the day she was born until for a year and a half, about 8 to 10 hours a day.
Patty Cake from the Bronx Zoo?
Well, she was then the Central Park Zoo.
Oh, Central Park
but
Zoo.
But yes, it was the same Patty Cake. And in terms of care for others, and I had so many observations, but one that comes to mind very quickly was at that point the zoo had guillotine doors in between the cages. And, of course, these were the old-fashioned cement cages with the bars. And one of the guillotine doors broke at one point, and they had somebody come in to fix it. But it had come down very quickly and had started Congo and Lulu. They were the parents of Patty Cake. And from then on, for about a week and a half, whenever Congo wanted to go through that door, Lulu would rush over first to test the door to see if it was safe for him to go through. Mm-hmm. She would take her hand and just test it to make sure it wasn't going to come down on him the way it almost had before.
That reminds me of a story that was told me by a caretaker at the Taronga Zoo of chimpanzees. A young chimpanzee had almost choked in a rope that was around her neck. And the mother liberated her child. But then afterwards, she went to the rope and she bit through the rope. She worked very hard in getting rid of that rope. So to take care of the problem. And that takes some, you know, that takes some imagination. It's like this happened once, this can happen many times. And so they take these precautions.
Susan, thank you. Before you go, some of our listeners will remember a series that we concluded on the show last year called The End of War, where we asked a whole variety of guests to respond to the question, can human beings ever abolish war? And we were surprised at how many of the hundreds of responses we received mentioned the peaceful bonobos as evidence for why humans can abolish war. And I wonder what you think. Can we look to the bonobo as proof or at least evidence that we humans are not an inherently aggressive or warlike species, given the genes that we share?
Well, it's very interesting that chimpanzees wage war between groups and males kill each other between groups and bonobos. Until now, we have absolutely no evidence, neither in captivity nor in the wild, that they do it. And they're exactly equally close to us. And so that gives us some hope. Also, as far as human warfare is concerned, it's often assumed that we have always been waging war But the actual evidence goes back only like 10,000, 12,000 years. So when we started the agricultural revolution and had land and possessions, that's where warfare started. We don't know if humans have always been waging war. And that's a sort of assumption, but it's really not proven at all.
And in evolutionary terms, can we hypothesize that we developed aggressive impulses from chimps and more altruistic or peaceful ones from bonobos?
I think we have a little bit of both. And I would never deny that humans are an aggressive species. I think we are. And we have done a lot of bad things in our history. But I'm not pessimistic. I think we can probably get over that.
Well, it's been a real honor to talk to you.
Thank you.
So interesting and inspirational, too. Franz de Waal, the renowned primatologist, his new book is The Bonobo and the Atheist, In Search of Humanism Among the Primates. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC. Coming up next, there's just been a very strange few minutes in Washington. We had been telling you that there would be a news conference to announce a deal on universal background checks for gun purchases, or nearly universal. We'll find out the details. But at the same time, President Obama was announcing details of his grand bargain budget proposal. So interesting that the senators chose to go ahead with their news conference, even at the same time that the president was speaking about something so big. We will have clips of both in just a minute and talk to a White House correspondent. So stay with us.